This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media's Midweek Podcast. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Well, we've arrived at the year's end, and we know what awaits us. A blizzard of 2021 best of lists. Best albums, best books, best movies, best books that became movies. That list includes House of Gucci, Nomadland, and Dune. But after a thorough search, we couldn't find a best of list for movies turned into books. Movie novelizations may be the red-headed stepchild of literature, but for some, it's a beloved genre. A few years back, then-OTM producer Jesse Brenneman reported this piece about his favorite kind of books.
You know the experience. You're standing in an airport or the grocery store checkout lane, and you notice a glossy paperback titled, say, Batman vs. Superman. And you think, I didn't know that was a book first. And then you see the dreaded words. Adapted from the screenplay. And you think, oh. And you keep moving. No, there's not much respect for the film novelization, and nobody knows it better than the people who write them.
But it seems to be the only thing that people recognize, so I usually say novelization and then in parentheses say dreaded term.
Max Allan Collins is author of over 30 novelizations, including Saving Private Ryan, The Mummy Trilogy, and Waterworld. Like many authors, he's worked his entire professional life to get out from under our disdain.
The nasty and sometimes deserved reputation of being subliterature.
That you have a bunch of writers who are not good enough to write books of their own. Just take a script and type it in book form for a quick check over a weekend.
That's Lee Goldberg, author of what he prefers to call media tie-ins, including two successful series of novels based on the television shows Monk and Diagnosis Murder. Goldberg and Collins were both fed up with the contempt for a trade that employs hundreds of writers and creates stacks of bestsellers, so they co-founded the International Association of Media Tie-In Writers, or IAMTW.
Or I am a tie-in writer. You know, the Mystery Writers of America, the Science Fiction Writers of America, the Romance Writers of America looked down their noses at these books. And we thought it was time that the authors toiling in this world got some respect, also demystified what they were doing, educated other writers and the media and readers about what goes into writing a tie-in novel.
So what exactly does go into writing a tie-in novel? First of all, a lot more than just copying and pasting.
I would largely throw the dialogue and the script away because I feel that movie script dialogue and novel dialogue are completely two different things.
Max Allan Collins.
Movies have a real habit of cutting from A to C or A to D, and people are hip enough to just sort of fill that in. But in a novel, the writer is expected to tell you how they got from, you know, the forest to the city. So it's a whole different way of viewing the material.
The very first novelization I did was 12 Monkeys.
That's Elizabeth Hand, who later novelized the 1998 X-Files film and Halle Berry's Catwoman. Hand was an author in her own right, but when tackling that first adaptation, she turned to her friend and fellow novelizer, Terry Bisson.
And then I said, Terry, what do I do? How do I do this? You know, I'm looking at this screenplay and there's not a lot there. There's just a little dialogue. And he said, well, he has this great Kentucky drawl. He said, well, the first thing you got to know is that when somebody walks into a room and sits in a chair, if that's what the stage direction says, he doesn't just walk in the room and sit in the chair. He ambles slowly across the oriental rugs that are covering the polished hardwood floors. And with a sigh, he sank deeply into the beautifully upholstered velvet wing chair. And I said, okay, well, I guess I can do that.
My eyes were open to the riches of the genre when I stumbled upon the novelization of the original Star Wars film. I was an adolescent Star Wars obsessive, and the book was amazing, not because it was just like the film, but because it was so different. In addition to new scenes and history, there were changes so arbitrary that they just had to have some deeper meaning. For instance, instead of the famous "a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away," the book begins with "another time, another galaxy."
Well, it was just a film. I mean, everything hadn't been codified and brought down from Mount Sinai.
That's Alan Dean Foster, author of the original Star Wars novelization, which he ghostwrote for George Lucas. And those cryptic changes that I endowed with such significance, chances are he made most of them up. Which he could do, because in 1976, George Lucas was just the director of American Graffiti, and Star Wars was not yet a multi-billion dollar industry.
Basically, it was, here's the screenplay, here's a couple of quick shots of people involved in the film. I saw about 10 minutes of rushes one day at Industrial Light and Magic. Go write the book. And I finished the book, I turned it in, George read it, said, that's fine. And that was it.
That a Star Wars fanatic like me could read Foster's book and think it was the original source material is, for novelizers like Max Allan Collins, the dream.
I run into people all the time that think, what a genius I must have been. You know, I created CSI, and I created Saving Private Ryan, and I created Air Force One, and all this stuff, which is just absurd. But I take some credit because the book was enough of a legitimate experience to them that they didn't just feel they were getting the literary equivalent of a lunchbox.
Which raises a question. Why is our admiration so contingent upon the order of the adaptation? For authors like Alan Dean Foster, it's a source of constant frustration.
It doesn't make any sense that you can take a best-selling book that sold millions of copies all over the world, like, say, Ben-Hur, extract a screenplay from it, win an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay, and everybody says that's a great piece of writing, when that's much easier to do than take a screenplay and make a novel out of it.
And plenty of novelizers have been stuck with unenviable tasks. There's a novelization of the Britney Spears film Crossroads.
Now I know that life doesn't always go my way.
It feels like I'm caught in the middle, and that's when I realize that I'm not a girl, I'm not yet a woman.
And then there are those novelizations whose very existence is mind-bending, like this one.
Ethan Hawke, Gwyneth Paltrow, with Anne Bancroft and Robert De Niro. Great Expectations.
The cover of which reads, novelization by Deborah Cheel, based on the novel by Charles Dickens, based on the motion picture written by Mitch Glazer. But the cream of the weird crop is easily the children's novelization of The Cat in the Hat, starring Mike Myers. The original Cat in the Hat begins like this.
The sun did not shine. It was too wet to play. So he sat in the house all that cold, cold, wet day.
The novelization begins like this.
The worst day ever. It really was. For starters, I was sitting in the family room, staring out the window. I mean, that's not the way I usually spend my Saturdays. But my Game Boy was taking a ride in my mom's purse, and the TV was tuned to C-SPAN. On a good day.
And yet sometimes less than stellar subject matter leads to the most successful novelizations. Lee Goldberg.
Elizabeth Hand wrote the novelization of the Catwoman screenplay. The Catwoman movie was a bomb with Halle Berry. The book was such a big bestseller, they talked about doing sequels to her novelization.
There was really nothing in the screenplay at all to go on with this character. So what I ended up doing, there was a character in the screenplay, a professor of catology, who tells her how she got her magic cat powers.
Elizabeth Hand.
So I ended up writing three or four little stories within the story that were drawn on different legends about cats. And I sort of held my breath to see if they would buy it.
And often, the studios don't. As Max Allan Collins learned the hard way when he found himself in the unique position of writing the novelization for the 2002 film Road to Perdition, based on his own graphic novel.
I sat down and I wrote 70, 80,000 word novel, very faithful to the movie script, but filling in things from the graphic novel. And they came back to me and said, we want nothing in here that isn't in the script. Nothing. And it was my characters. They were not allowing me to do anything with my characters. That was a very unhappy experience.
So why do they do it?
Sebastian Fox and William Boyd are literary novelists, and yet they pandered to do a James Bond novel? Why?
Lee Goldberg.
Well, it's James Bond. A lot of authors feel the same way about Star Wars or Star Trek or the X-Men or Bunk or whatever. They want to have a chance to write those characters that they love, to explore those worlds.
For Max Allan Collins, it helps to remember who his intended audience is.
I did Waterworld. I don't know if I want to know the 55-year-old guy that picked up Waterworld and read it. I'm not really sure I want to hang with that guy. But the 14-year-old who read it and wrote me a letter about it, you know what? He's going to grow up. He's going to be reading all through those years. And if he loved my book, I got a customer.
Plus, you know.
Writers always need money.
Elizabeth Hand.
Samuel Johnson said, no man but a blockhead ever wrote except for money.
Beethoven didn't sit around turning out symphonies for fun.
Alan Dean Foster.
They're all done in commission. They're all done to be paid. And Rembrandt sat around painting fat businessmen all day. And I don't think that that's probably what he wanted to paint all the time.
And as you dive further into the history of novelizations, something else starts to become clear. The relationship between films and books is not always so straightforward. The first hit novelization was 1932's King Kong, which was released as a promotion before the film. Fritz Lang's classic Metropolis was based on the novel written by his wife, Thea von Harbau, which she wrote with the movie in mind. And Arthur C. Clarke's 2001 A Space Odyssey novel came out after Stanley Kubrick's film, but Kubrick and Clarke developed the book together as a precursor to the movie. In that screenplay, there's a line that seems to speak directly to the novelizer's task.
I am putting myself to the fullest possible use, which is all I think that any conscious entity can ever hope to do.
Or perhaps, on more cynical days, it's a line from another classic.
Look, I ain't in this for your revolution, and I'm not in it for you, princess. I expect to be well paid. I'm in it for the money.
A line which is in the novelization, albeit with a few minor changes. We're on the media. I'm Jesse Brenneman.
Thanks for listening to the Midweek Podcast. Check out the big show. It's usually posted on Friday around dinner time. And check out our hilariously peculiar newsletter written by Sandra Ellen. And thanks for sticking with us.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.